So we've been looking at the return of economic prosperity to Grand Rapids during the years after World War II. One really striking local economic development of the decade was the maturing and expansion of the Itasca County resort industry. More than ever, the businessmen of Grand Rapids realized the importance of dollars brought to the area by summer visitors. Although the old hope for a great mining industry located in the Grand Rapids area had come to the fore again during the war years, a more realistic concept was of a town that would serve as the gateway to the burgeoning resort industry. A lasting working relationship between scattered independent resort owners and the businessmen of Grand Rapids was difficult to develop and required continuing effort. A new resort owners association formed with headquarters in Grand Rapids, and it immediately received the plaudits of the Herald Review. The newspaper pointed out that such a highly competitive business needed regional cooperation. The new association, working closely with the Grand Rapids Commercial Club, coordinated and expanded advertising for Itasca County resorts and aided in developing the tourism industry. The association assumed sponsorship of the Itasca booth at the Chicago Recreational Exposition and then sent representatives to similar affairs in St. Louis and in Minneapolis. It accepted reservations for specific resorts and disseminated literature extolling the recreational opportunities of Itasca County. Grand Rapids contributed still more to the resort operators of Itasca County when the Commercial Club erected a small frame structure on a corner of the central school grounds to serve as a tourist information center. Every summer, it distributed maps and brochures and answered inquiries about the resorts. The service proved valuable, and in 1948, the school board granted permission to erect a more attractive and durable log structure. There were offices and more space to increase tourist usage. By the end of 1941, about 200 resorts operated in Itasca County. Some 1,250 tourist cabins rented for $15 to $25 per week, and along with a fleet of about 1,500 boats, they attracted visitors from throughout the Midwest. Summer travelers spent an estimated $41 million in the county that year. Even during the war, and despite the shortages, the resort business was brisk. Camp Mishawaka, still following the guidelines set by George Green, attracted more boys than ever in 1942 and 43. When the war ended and gasoline rationing was over, the resorts quickly felt the pressure of a surge of new business. The Herald Review advised resort owners to expand their season into May to avoid later overcrowding. The newspaper also called upon all owners to keep their properties attractive and modern so as to retain the county's reputation as a first-class resort area. They needed to make every effort to stave off increasing competition from other parts of Minnesota. Some established Itasca resorts expanded their facilities, and 50 new places opened in the immediate post-war years. Over 50,000 tourists visited the area in 1946. A 1949 editorial in the Herald Review pointed out that the Itasca resort industry had grown as a result of its own efforts without capital from outside sources. The typical resort may have sprung from the frontier farm or home upon a lake. A cabin was built, soon another followed. After a few cabins came a larger and better dining room. Every penny that was made was put right back into cabins, boats, and furnishings. The resort owner seldom had money in the bank. The whole industry has been built room by room, cabin by cabin, by some very courageous and self-sacrificing people, the Herald Review stated. The resort owners of Itasca County may have eked out a rather meager living, but they added much to the economic well-being of the Grand Rapids region. Agricultural developments in Itasca County did not meet former high expectations. the 3,105 farms listed in the 1940 census represented a 40% increase over 1930, quite in excess of the 5% increase in the state as a whole. But Itasca farms were small, averaging 85 acres, and that's just half of the statewide average, just half of it. Furthermore, although Itasca farms covered about one-sixth of the land area of the large county, only about 25% of that amount was actually under cultivation. The number of farms had increased during the 1930s, partly because Itasca land was inexpensive, but the farmers soon learned how hard it was to make an adequate living there, no matter how much energy they expended. Fewer than half of the farmers were able to support themselves by agriculture alone, and most depended on outside work for some income. Rising food prices during the 1940s helped but did not basically change the Itasca farming situation. Grand Rapids merchants encouraged agricultural development and sponsored an annual festival in the fall in honor of those who cultivated potatoes and who consistently won potato honors at the Minnesota State Fair. And I'm looking at a picture here of a very exuberant-looking Judy Garland, big smile, sparkling eyes. She had been invited to that potato festival and was very happy to come back to her dearly beloved Grand Rapids. And here she is holding a big sack of Arrowhead Select potatoes. But Itasca potatoes did not become as well-known as sun-kissed oranges as C.K. Blandin had once suggested they should. The reason may be gleaned from comments made at a forum at the University of Minnesota Farm Campus in St. Paul in 1946. The major problem facing Minnesota potato growers was poor marketing. Unlike the clean, uniform, well-packaged potatoes from Idaho, Minnesota potatoes were often sold ungraded for size, poorly washed, and too frequently knobby or scabbed. The Herald Review admitted that this was true to some extent in Itasca County. In a 1949 editorial, Rossman recounted a story about a doctor who was called to tend an elderly Itasca County farmer. The doctor decided his patient needed hospitalization and drove him to town. Along the way, the farmer said he was very tired and worked out. He continued with a telling observation, remarking that one lifetime is not long enough to develop a farm in the timber. The cutover land and the cold northern climate took a heavy toll of human endurance and provided only a fraction of the yield of the Red River Valley or of the rich black farmland in southern Minnesota. Some perspective on this farming again. His comment, one lifetime is not long enough to develop a farm in the timber. Well, we may take that comment as ending the myth in regard to the great garden wonderland of Itasca County. As we have seen in the early decades of the century, that myth, and the myth was establishing a farm in the area led to immediate prosperity and the comfort of being able to afford to build a home and a barn and needed outbuildings. And all across southern Minnesota, the word was passed through leaflets written and distributed from Grand Rapids with invitation to come and partake in the farming opportunity provided in this remarkable place. Those behind this effort were influenced by the overly optimistic conclusions that had been widely accepted that agriculture would indeed add significantly to the Grand Rapids area economic base. The cold climate, short growing season, stumps, and in many parts of the county, poor soil, was simply ignored. The influx of new farms that resulted from the exaggerated promises did not result in immediate prosperity, and many of those farms floundered, and those who had come were left stranded, and that was a major reason why welfare costs to the county was among the highest in the state during the Depression years. We may wonder if those who wrote those enticing tracts ever realized the harm that they'd caused. At any rate, the garden wonderland was no more. Farming would be an important part of the economic structure of Itasca County, but not in the grand manner that had been promised. Indeed, one lifetime is not long enough to develop a farm in the timber, better express the reality facing the farmers of the area. By the 1940s, timber was more appreciated as the major crop of the northern area. Most of the great stands of pine were, of course, long gone, but smaller sawmills and the paper company used quantities of wood. This did more for the local economy than had the earlier huge operations that floated logs downstream to be made into lumber elsewhere. In 1946, an 82-pound two-man chainsaw of German design demonstrated near Grand Rapids, attracted much attention. Modern technology was about to revolutionize the pulpwood industry of northern Minnesota. During the 1940s, many Grand Rapids citizens became particularly interested in air travel, the possibilities of linking the town with the outside world to a degree not remotely conceived by earlier residents was intriguing. Resort owner Arthur Otis constructed a small landing strip complete with lights catering to tourists arriving by plane. His success sparked even more discussion in Grand Rapids about the economic impact that an airport could have on the town. In 1946, after many years of publicity and frequent press coverage of matters related to air travel and transportation, a bond issue handily passed, enabling construction of a sizable runway for the little airport that WPA workers had built south of town in the 1930s. An editorial in the Herald Review cited the event as important as earlier road construction, placing Grand Rapids on the map. A few years later, a still larger expenditure of funds extended the runway. Grand Rapids was accessible for transient aircraft and ready for scheduled air service as well.